is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. Worry, anxiety, and fear can dominate our lives, especially in times like this of intense economic and personal crisis. Is peace of mind, is an abiding sense of tranquility and equanimity, is that possible for people like us who are always taught to seek more, want more, need more? What can philosophers tell us about contentment and peace of mind and how to achieve them? Stoicism was a popular and influential school of philosophy in ancient Greece and Rome, perhaps because the Stoic philosophers did something quite remarkable. They devised practical strategies for reducing anxiety, for dealing with loss, for reining in our desires, and much more. That philosophy and those strategies are laid out in a new book entitled A Guide to the Good Life, The Ancient Art of Stoic Joy, published by Oxford University Press. Its author, William Irvin, teaches philosophy at Wright State University. Today, for the first time, we present the full-length interview I taped with Bill Irvin on January 28th. KPFA listeners heard portions of that interview during the recently ended winter fun drive. Now we have the opportunity to play the entire conversation. I began by asking Bill Irvin whether most people consciously develop a philosophy of life.
I think it's something people don't think about. They fall into what, for most people, is the default philosophy of life, which is a form of enlightened hedonism. And they want to have be comfortable, they want to experience pleasure, they want to avoid pain, and most people never get beyond that.
Tell me more about enlightened hedonism and why so many people adopt that philosophy.
Well, let's talk a little bit, first of all, about hedonism. And, of course, hedonism, a hedonist is a person who simply wants to be comfortable and enjoy, experience as much pleasure as he can in life. I suspect that we were evolutionarily programmed to seek pleasure and avoid pain. So it's kind of programmed into it, and that's why I say it's our default philosophy of life.
And why is it important to have a philosophy of life other than a kind of enlightened hedonism?
Well, the danger is that you will mislive, that you'll spend your life doing things that seem sensible and realize very late in the game that, in fact, you had this wonderful one-time opportunity at life and you spent it either pursuing the wrong things or maybe pursuing the right things, but pursuing them in a foolish manner. And you'll end up with a lot of regrets.
So how did you first become interested in Stoicism?
I became interested in it in a roundabout way. My book before this book was titled On Desire, Why We Want What We Want, and it was a wide-ranging explanation of human desire. And I went into that with a kind of an ulterior motive. I knew that in the process of doing research for that book that I would be able to explore Zen Buddhism in considerable detail, and I sort of thought that I would come out of the research project a full-fledged Zen Buddhist. And then a funny thing happened. The more I learned about Zen Buddhism, the more I realized that the fit just wasn't right between Zen Buddhism and myself. I'm a relentlessly analytical person, and Zen Buddhism would require me to turn off a lot of that analysis. Now, I'm not saying Zen Buddhism is a bad philosophy of life. There are many interesting parallels, in fact, between it and Stoicism. It's just that for me, the fit didn't work. Given my personality and my circumstances, it didn't work. And then the other surprise in the research was Stoicism, which at one time would have been a non-starter for me as a philosophy of life. The fit was wonderful. I found myself in a low-key way putting their advice to work in my everyday life. And before I knew it, I was this rare entity, a 21st century human being who was a practicing Stoic.
What parallels did you find between Zen Buddhism and Stoicism?
One thing is they both think tranquility should be one of your primary goals in life. And once I say that, I have to do a little bit of explaining because some people think that by tranquility, I mean, the kind you could get by ingesting a tranquilizer. But for both of them, tranquility meant the relative absence of negative emotions in your life. negative emotions like anger, fear, grief, anxiety, and the presence of positive emotions, with the most positive of positive emotions being feelings of joy. Both the Zen Buddhists and the Stoics believe that you should not become attached to things, you shouldn't cling to the world around you, and the Stoics develop some wonderful techniques for avoiding doing that. Both thought that to the extent possible, you should live in the present moment. And the Stoics were emphatic about this. I mean, most people go through life. The present moment consists of anxiety about the future moments they're going to experience and regrets about the past moments. And they were very interested in overcoming those emotional states so that you could embrace the present moment. And in fact, more generally, so you could embrace the life you're living, whatever that life might be.
Well, one thing you're very interested in overcoming are popular conceptions, popular misconceptions of what Stoicism is and what a Stoic is. Could you remind us what most people and you, in fact, before you got into this field, think about what a Stoic is and how a person who is a Stoic acts?
Yeah, Stoicism, the Stoics in general are victims of a bum rap. And unless you're an unusual person, everything you know about Stoicism is wrong. I mean, that was certainly the case with me, and I had studied philosophy, you know, as an undergraduate. I was a major, and then I went to graduate school. But people commonly think that the Stoics, the uppercase S Stoics, were lowercase s stoical, and that is that they were grim and unfeeling individuals, that they were emotional icebergs who kind of stood there and quietly took whatever life threw at them. And I knew when I was doing the research for this book, friends would say, "What's this next book going to be on?" And I would say, "It's the Stoics." And you could see the look in their eye. You could see the life drain out of them, you know, because they weren't sure what the follow-up question was. And one friend said, "Well, weren't they the ones that were really stiff?" Which is just a strange notion. But as I say, it turns out that the Stoics aren't opposed to emotion, but they're very much in favor of minimizing the number of negative emotions that we experience. And when I started reading about the lives of the Stoics themselves, it turns out that they were an unusually cheerful bunch of people. And you can find any number of passages where they tell you that what they're aiming at is joy, a state of joy. So it's the opposite of what you would think. I mean, other things came up in the research. It turns out that the skeptics weren't skeptics. The cynics weren't cynical in the modern sense. So we have a pretty dramatic misconception of all of these ancient philosophies.
We can't talk about Stoicism without going back many centuries to the, I believe, 5th and 4th centuries B.C., you write that many affluent Greek and Roman parents in a time of growing democracy sent their children to be educated at schools of philosophy. Why is that?
Well, back then, if you think about how parents try to educate their kids now, I mean, there's two factors in the education. There's a kind of a moral upbringing, the sense of values. You want to implant values in your children. And the other thing you want to do is get them ready for whatever career they're going to end up in as adults. Back then, religion, now religion is typically a component in the way parents raise their children. Back then, it wasn't, because religion was different than our current conception of religion. Back then, religion was simply about keeping the gods happy. It wasn't about morality. It wasn't about values in life. So parents back then, if they wanted their kids to have some direction in life, would send them to a school of philosophy, where typically they would get two sorts of training. This would be in their late teen years, you know, the last step before embarking on adulthood. It was usually men. I guess there are examples of women who attended schools of philosophy. It was usually men, and the men would go and learn skills that would be valuable in their subsequent career, typically a career in politics or law. So they'd learn how to argue. They'd learn public speaking. But then the other big component was what I call a philosophy of life. It would instruct them on what things in life were valuable and how they could most effectively pursue those things.
And one school of philosophy was founded by a guy named Zeno of Citium, born in 333 BC. In Athens, he became the pupil of a Cynic, a member of the Cynic school of philosophy. Can you tell us a little bit about the Cynics? And then I want to ask you about similarities and differences between the Cynics and the Stoics.
Yeah, the Cynics were just a wonderful group of individuals. They were the ancient equivalent of what we would call the homeless. They were extremely ascetic. They had no possessions. They tried to live as simple a life as they could. And they would spend their days going around and trying to get other people see the mistakes in living that they were making. So, you know, in the same way as Stoics were interested in the values people would choose in life, the Cynics were interested in that as well. The Cynics, though, were much more aggressive than the Stoics. So there are stories of the Cynics actually going into someone's house, you know, and saying, "You, how are you living? Are you living the right way?" The Cynics also had wonderful senses of humor, a lot of great jokes and stories involving the Cynics. And Zeno of Citium, the first of the Stoics, he's the guy who invented Stoicism. He actually started out as a student of one of the Cynics and then decided that Cynicism wasn't for him. It was too ascetic. And so he came up with his own philosophy that has a Cynic component in it, but doesn't have the level of asceticism that the Cynics favored.
So what is the Cynic component he retained?
He retained a notion of the importance of living a simple life and of valuing the right things, but he said the Cynics were making a mistake. The Cynics would allow no luxuries into their lives, and they said, you know, we are going to turn our back on all of these. And that made it a very difficult philosophy for people to follow. But Zeno said that that was, in fact, a mistake, that in life you should enjoy the good things life has to offer. But you should enjoy them very carefully, and in particular, as you enjoy them, you should keep consciously in mind that they could be gone, that in fact this could be the last time that you enjoy them. So they weren't ascetic to the same level as the Cynics were, and that made it a much more acceptable philosophy of life to people in the ancient world, and I think for 21st century individuals as well.
We're speaking with William Irvin. He is a professor of philosophy at Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio, and author most recently of A Guide to the Good Life, The Ancient Art of Stoic Joy, recently out from Oxford University Press. My name is C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and also online at kpfa.org. You were speaking earlier, Bill, about tranquility and the importance and emphasis that Stoics placed on tranquility. You also write in this book about the value of, or I should say, the priority of virtue, that the Stoics also thought virtue was worth pursuing. What did they mean by virtue?
Yeah, it's interesting. In my book, the primary focus is on the Roman Stoics who came, you know, first century AD, and they were preceded by the Greek Stoics. For the Greek Stoics, the primary concern was the pursuit of virtue, and it's a word that unfortunately has changed meanings. If you talk about somebody being virtuous, you think that, well, gee, they don't party a lot, they're not promiscuous, sexually promiscuous, that would be a virtuous individual. But to the ancient Greeks, a virtuous person was an excellent human being, a human being who performed well the function for which human beings were created. Back then, they would have believed that the gods made us with a certain function in mind, and a virtuous human being played that function well.
And what function did they believe humans were designed to perform?
Well, we're a curious hybrid, if you believe their story of creation. We're a curious hybrid. We're half animal and half God. So we have the godlike component, which is our reasoning ability, but we also have all of the animal emotions, you know, anger and lust and everything else. And so our predicament then is how to live with both of those present in us. The interesting thing about the reasoning ability, though, is we can use it to get our way out of the human predicament. That is, we can use it to overcome those negative emotions, which is precisely what the Stoics were advising that we do. When I said that Zen wasn't sufficiently analytical for me and Stoicism was, the Stoics valued very much our reasoning ability and said that if we want to have a good life, we need to use that reasoning ability to analyze our situation and then figure out how best to overcome these negative emotions so we can have the best life possible for us to have.
You said that the Romans took up Stoicism after the Greeks. Why did the Romans put more emphasis on the attainment of tranquility than the Greeks had?
They just seem to have been more pragmatic, more practical-minded. You know, back then, if you had a school of philosophy, you had to get students or you went out of business, and perhaps your philosophy of life became extinct. So I think they were more practical-minded. They had competitors in the philosophical landscape, including the Epicureans, who also promised that if their students would listen to what they had to say, they would gain tranquility. And I might throw in at this point, by the way, that the pursuit of virtue and the pursuit of tranquility are not mutually exclusive. The idea is that a virtuous person is more likely to experience tranquility than someone who isn't virtuous, and also someone who attains tranquility might find it easier to attain virtue. So the two actually go hand in hand very nicely.
We could spend several days talking about the great Roman Stoics. Let me ask you about two of them, and maybe we could just address them briefly right now, and I'm sure you will want to bring up some of their ideas as they come up later on as we talk about the psychological techniques advocated by the Stoics. But the two that I'd like to ask you about are Seneca and Marcus Aurelius. Tell us a little bit about these two men.
Seneca was a philosopher, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. He was also a playwright, in fact, one of the greatest playwrights of his age. He was counselor to the Emperor Nero. That's before Nero got crazy. He was also an investment banker who became fantastically wealthy through his investments. He's very accessible. He has written a number of essays and a number of letters that, you know, if you're a non-philosopher and you pick up a typical philosophy book, a lot of times it's simply inaccessible. But the works of Seneca are wonderfully accessible and wonderful to read. Marcus Aurelius, besides being a philosopher, was not merely a Roman emperor, but one of the greatest Roman emperors. So, you know, there's that old saying about a philosopher king. I've been around philosophers a long time, and I'm pretty sure I wouldn't want to have a philosopher as king. but if I did have to have one, Marcus Aurelius would be a wonderful candidate for that, because he seems to have done the job very well. It's also interesting because his practice of Stoicism seems to have helped him withstand all of the rigors of being an emperor in that day and age.
We're talking, Bill, about two incredibly wealthy, very powerful people. Do you see that as being in conflict to any degree with Stoicism, with Stoic philosophy?
The Stoics, again, were unlike the Cynics. The Cynics would have had nothing to do with palace life. The Stoics said, it's okay to enjoy the good things in life, but you have to enjoy them without clinging to them, realizing that they could be gone at any particular moment. And both, well, Seneca, in his writings, he describes the things he would do to avoid clinging to these good things he found himself surrounded with. One of the interesting things was he was an advocate of, he called it practicing poverty. So if you find yourself extremely affluent, as he did, you'd make a point. Every now and then, he doesn't specify the exact interval, but every now and then you would take a few days and you would live as if you were a poor person, you know, wearing the simplest clothes you could find, eating the simplest foods you could find. It had a therapeutic benefit to do that. And it's one of those interesting techniques that the Stoics talk about that'll help you enjoy life and enjoy the good things in life, but at the same time prepare yourself if life should take a turn for the worse.
Let's turn to some of the psychological techniques advocated by the Stoics. One that they advocated had to do with something you call negative visualization. What's that?
Yeah, what I just mentioned, practicing poverty, is one form of negative visualization. In negative visualization, you actively think about the bad things that could happen to you. You actively think about how your life could be worse. You contemplate it, so I don't want you to get the idea that the Stoics sit around and just dwell on this and just are anxious about it. But you just imagine the things that could happen that are negative. So what do you imagine? In practicing poverty, you imagine that your wealth is gone. You don't only imagine it, you live as if it were gone. Some other things they would advise, they would say your friends. We all know that friendships can come to an end. You know, sometimes friends quarrel, sometimes friends die. And so the Stoics said, you know, when you say goodbye to your friend, one of the things you should do is you should allow the thought just briefly to enter your mind that this might be the last time you see your friend. Why would anybody do that? It seems like such a negative thing to do. It's because if you do that, you'll appreciate that friend in a way you won't appreciate him if you think, as most people do, that he'll be there forever. Another thing the Stoics said you should contemplate is your own death. And again, that seems like a terribly negative thing to do, except they claim that by contemplating your own death and by thinking, by realizing fully that you won't be here forever, if you do that, you will enjoy life so much more intensely than if you imagine, as many people do, that they're going to be around forever.
You bring up in this chapter the example of two fathers, one of whom periodically reflects on his daughter's mortality. Take us through this scenario.
Yeah, this is a line from the Stoic philosopher Epictetus, who gives this advice. He said, as you're kissing your daughter goodnight at bedtime, you should pause and think to yourself that this might be the last kiss, that she might be gone by tomorrow, by the morning. And when I've had my students read that, they're all just appalled. That's a terrible thing to do with a kid. Now, you're doing it in your own mind. You're not telling the kid, you know, you might die tonight, but you're reflecting on that. The claim is, and I believe this is true because I've done it, the claim is that if you do that, you will value your daughter. If your daughter is around the next day, as she probably will be, you'll appreciate her continued existence. And compare that to the father who assumes that the kid's always going to be around. That father is unlikely to be attentive. You know, when the kid comes down for breakfast, that father might just continue reading the newspaper. That afternoon, instead of playing with the kid, the father might go golfing. Because you know what? You can always play with the kid tomorrow. The first father, though, the one that actively contemplates the loss of the daughter, is going to take advantage of opportunities to interact. It's going to be a much closer relationship.
We often take things for granted, and I think one of the powerful justifications or reasons for doing negative visualization is precisely because we start appreciating things we took for granted beforehand. And this also has to do something with desire, and you bring up a phrase called hedonic adaptation. I guess two psychologists came up with that term. What is that, and how is that related to contemplating the bad things that could happen to us?
Yes, psychological adaptation is the process by which whatever you get in life, you take for granted. It's a really an insidious process. So here's how it works. We go through life forming dreams for ourselves. I mean, we might think of the perfect job. We might think of the perfect boyfriend or girlfriend or marrying the perfect person or having kids. And we work really hard to fulfill those dreams. And with hard work, we might succeed in fulfilling those dreams. And then a very unfortunate thing happens. We lose interest in the dream. We start taking it for granted. So yeah, we marry the person of our dreams, and then 6 months later we find ourselves thinking, gee, are there greener pastures out there?
And or we buy the car we've always wanted, and we feel differently about it after a time.
Yes, and that's the standard process with consumer goods, all of the neat gadgets and leather goods and everything else we find ourselves lusting after. We get them, and there's that initial rush. I won't deny that. But then a short time later, the joy is out of the relationship or the ownership, and suddenly we want more. If you want to have a good life will be a life in which you feel satisfied. Hedonic adaptation prevents you from gaining satisfaction because of this process, this psychological process. You work hard to get something, and then once you get it, you no longer value the thing you worked hard to get, and so you have to work hard to get something else. One of the principal insights of the Stoics is that they came across a technique to stop this psychological process, this hedonic adaptation, and the process that they invented was negative visualization. So you work hard to get something. Once you get it, how can you keep being interested in it? How can you avoid taking it for granted? They said, well, you should spend time actively thinking about what your life would be like if you lost that thing you possess. So that car you got, one thing that can happen is you drive it around and you start looking at the other cars on the road and you start thinking, oh, well, you know, I could use a newer, better car. Well, another way to do it is the car you've got. Think about how you'd feel if it were stolen, if it were taken, if you couldn't have afforded it in the first place. And you can even break this down into smaller details. One of the things you take for granted involves your car, and that is the thought that when you get in it and turn the key, the engine's going to start and you're going to go roaring off to wherever you want to go. It's useful to think when you get in and the key starts that it didn't need to start, and you could have been sitting there in that frustrated state of mind, thinking, why won't my car start? But that didn't happen. And the curious thing is, if you do enough of this, what would normally be just everyday moments in life get this kind of nice glow to them. You realize things are actually pretty good.
It's an exquisite insight, this notion of, or this, I don't know what you would say, this habit the Stoics would have us develop of desiring not what we don't have, but desiring what we already have.
Yes. I mean, two things. Number one, learn to want the things you already have, because you already have them. And then the second thing is, although you want the things you have, and they're very careful on this, don't cling to the things you have. So learn to want the things you already have, and at the same time, don't cling to the things you already have. And, you know, the process I just described actually accomplishes both things. So if I imagine my car being stolen or burning up in a fire in the night or whatever, I will appreciate it more that I've got it. And also by visualizing the negative things that can happen to my car, in a sense, I prepare myself for the loss of the car. In a sense, I will have seen it coming. Same is true of friendships. Friends die. If you contemplate the loss of those friends, you accomplish two things. If you do lose it, you will have seen it coming. That'll take some of the sting out of it. And as long as the friendship continues, you'll value it much more intensely than you would if you took it for granted and imagined that it would always be something you could enjoy.
William Irvin is his name, Irvine. He joins us by phone from Dayton, Ohio, where he teaches philosophy at Wright State University. He's author of On Desire, Why We Want What We Want, and he's author most recently of A Guide to the Good Life, The Ancient Art of Stoic Joy, recently published by Oxford University Press. We have a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. I'm CS, this is Against the Grain, and kpfa.org is where you can listen to us live. Bill, you bring up, this is very poignant among many other things in this book, but you bring up the fact that the world sometimes gives us advance notice that we are about to do something for the last time. What does that advance notice do to how we experience it, and how does negative visualization enhance our experiences?
Sometimes, and one example I use in the book, and that is the parting kiss. So suppose you're in love with someone, and you know they're going to go to the other side of the world, maybe forever. At any rate, you might not see them ever again. It might be a long time before you see them again. And then there's that parting kiss, which is one of the most beautifully bittersweet experiences life has to offer, one of the most intense experiences life has to offer. And the problem is, most people only have that intensity of experience when they actually are losing the thing that they so enjoy. By practicing negative visualization, you can have maybe not fully that intensity of experience, but you can have something like that. And that is, if you keep in mind that that person you love, won't be there forever, it just makes the relationship that much more intense. Same thing. I mean, here's another related point. In some religions, people are encouraged to say grace at a meal. And I think some of them do it probably for the wrong reasons. They don't want to get in trouble. They don't want to sin. They don't want to do something to offend God. But I think that saying grace, done in its proper sense, is a wonderful thing to do, and it's actually a form of negative visualization. Because when you say grace, what you're doing is you're reflecting on the fact that this food didn't have to be here, that these people you're sharing the meal with didn't have to be here. And if you do it in the proper frame of mind, the simple act of saying grace, you know, thinking that this didn't have to have happened, can turn what would be a meal that you would eat in a thoughtless fashion, can turn it into a cause for celebration, that I have this food, that I have these friends who are sharing this food.
Let's turn to a chapter which has as its subtitle, On Becoming Invincible. What must happen in the Stoic way of thinking to our desires in order for us to be invincible?
The things life throws at you, you have to do a kind of a triage, and you have to realize that the things life throws at you fall into one of three categories. There's things over which you have complete control, things over which you have no control at all, and things over which you have some but not complete control. It's very foolish to spend your life worrying about things over which you have no control at all, and yet so many people spend their lives doing that. What are the things over which you have complete control? Stoics said you can control your values, your goals, your character, and you should put a considerable amount of effort into developing your values, in choosing the proper values, in developing your character. What are the things you have some control over but not complete control over? Well, I mean, you know, think about recreational activities like playing tennis. There's no guarantee that you'll win a game. Yet, by trying hard, you can affect the outcome of a game. So the Stoics would say, put your energy into that. But there are other things it's just pointless to worry about because you have no control at all over how they turn out.
Yeah, and this is really one of the puzzles, because in my personal life, I will get upset over things that, of course, I realize later on, or even maybe at that moment, that I have no control over. It could be traffic lights. It could be the behavior of somebody whose conduct depends not at all on my conduct.
Yeah, and I guess I've gone through a kind of a personal transition here. I find being stuck in traffic, it's not perfectly tolerable. I don't know if it ever will be, but more tolerable than it used to. It's just a different frame of mind of realizing, well, I'm stuck in traffic, and I can either let this ruin my day, and a lot of people do, or I can do my best to enjoy this little interlude and try not to let it ruin my day. I have no control over it. If I fret over it, become anxious over it, all I succeed in doing is taking a bad situation and make it worse.
Okay, so let's return to your tennis match example. So this is something that we have some control over, but not complete control, because we are playing someone else and it's up to them and their abilities to some degree. There's luck probably involved, how we happen to feel that day, the level of our performance that day. What attitude would the Stoics want us to take toward the issue of winning or losing that match?
Stoics would say that if you go into the game and your goal is to win, you're setting yourself up for possible bad feelings later on. A much wiser strategy is to, and the phrase I use for it, is to internalize your goals. So what you do is you make your goal something you do have complete or at least considerable control over, and then you can't lose. So what goal would that be? Well, the goal of trying your best in the game, of training as hard as you can for the game, of trying your best in the game. Then it's entirely within your control whether you achieve that goal. I should also point out here, by the way, that that's one of the best ways to actually win a tennis game, is to train to the best of your ability and play to the best of your ability.
Yeah, and it's fascinating what you point out in this book, which is that focusing on an external goal like winning could actually, what, hurt one's chances of achieving that very goal?
Sure. If you're intent on winning this tennis game and things start going against you, then it's easy to get rattled, and getting rattled can affect your play. But if your goal is to play to the best of your ability, then, you know, if the score isn't going quite how you want it to do, you can still be confident that, well, it isn't going how I hoped, but still I'm doing the best I can in the situation, and that was my goal coming in.
Let's take a couple of other examples. So, for example, a worker trying to please her boss and a novelist who wants to get published.
You can't be sure that you'll please your boss. Bosses can be fickle about such things. But one thing you can do is do your best. That's all you can do. I have an extended discussion of a would-be novelist. It's a very precarious position to be in, because you're going to have to experience a lot of negativity from the time when you first sit down and decide you're going to write a novel to the time you finally get it published. You're going to hear no a lot of times. You're going to find that friends and relatives aren't necessarily as encouraging as they might be. And it's going to be a very difficult process. I suspect that many novelists fail. I mean, they never publish simply because they can't stand the external failure of getting letters of rejection, or, as often happens, getting no letter at all in response to something you submit. So it's a classic example of a case where internalizing your goals is a wonderful device to use to increase your chances of success. So instead of saying, my goal is to publish this novel, say my goal is to submit this novel a certain number of times in a certain period. My goal is to make this the finest work that I can make this. My goal is to rewrite this and then rewrite it again. Goals where you have complete control. And again, the point is, those internal goals, by having those, you're less likely to experience that overwhelming sense of failure, and you're actually likely to increase your chances of succeeding.
Are we, in some ways, though, promoting a kind of self-deception, because this novelist may well have as his or her goal, ultimate goal, getting published? So maybe we can make that person think the goal is different, but are we really changing anything?
It is self-deception, and the Stoics have nothing against self-deception. Here's their way of thinking. We've got this animal component in us that generates all of these emotions. Emotions are a psychological state, and then the question is, how do you best fight the fight against the emotions? And the answer is, you trick them. So the thing we were talking about earlier, negative visualization, is yet another mental trick. If you do that, you can forestall hedonic adaptation. And in this case, by playing this trick of telling yourself, well, my goal isn't really to win the tennis game, my goal is to play to the best of my ability, you can block out certain negative emotions that would otherwise appear. So, yeah, it's a trick. The Stoics are unapologetic about that. You fight your emotions the best way you can, and if you have a subtle, underhanded way of doing that, so much the better if it works.
William Irvin joins us today on Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Song. His last name is spelled I-R-V-I-N-E. He's a professor of philosophy at Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio. And his new book, A Guide to the Good Life, The Ancient Art of Stoic Joy, sets forth a number of psychological techniques advocated by or adapted by William Irvin from his reading of Stoic philosophy that can guide us through many of the obstacles and irritations of daily life. He has chapters on anger, on grief, on insults, on personal values, on old age, dying. But in our time remaining, I wanted to make sure we had a chance to talk about insults. Life involves being insulted or put down, both by people we know and by complete strangers. You use the term insult quite broadly, don't you?
Yeah. Insult can be a physical insult. It can be a verbal insult. But some of the best insults are insults by implication, where somebody doesn't actually say something insulting, yet you go away feeling insulted. But the Stoics had this interesting take on insults. They are what I call insult pacifists. They said the best thing you can do in response to an insult is nothing at all. If you must say something, try to engage in some self-deprecating humor. It's something you don't hear people do very often, but I've been experimenting with it, and it seems to be quite successful as a strategy for dealing with insults.
And what can we do with our attitude toward insults? How do we take the sting out of them?
Well, you have to realize that insults hurt because we care what other people think of us. And I would claim that that's also part of our evolutionary programming. Our evolutionary ancestors who cared about their social status were more likely to survive and reproduce than those who were indifferent. This would have been in a time when, you know, people formed little groups and the alpha male had greatest access to resources and so on. But we continue to have that programming in us, even though we no longer travel in small groups around the savannas of Africa. So it's a curious evolutionary artifact that we carry with us. It's some evolutionary baggage. So for them, they said it's very important that you realize that you can't control what other people think of you. You know what, even if you do wonderful things for them, even if you buy them a new car, or, I don't know, give them a kidney, you can be really, really nice to them. And it could just increase the chance that they hate you, you know, or it could trigger envy in them. So you can't control what other people think of you. So stop worrying about it. Worry instead about things you can control, like your character. Try to become an honest person. Try to become a magnanimous person. And it's a curious thing, but there's a good chance that if you do that, people will like you better than if you went out of your way to try to make them like you.
Mm. The Stoics would also have us consider the source of the insult, correct?
Right. Realize that somebody who insults you has probably different values than you do. That's why they're insulting you. You aren't living in accordance with their values. And then once you keep that in mind, you can discount many of the insults. You realize, well, this is because he values something different than I do. I value tranquility. He values, I don't know, cars, fancy watches. He values something else. And it's sort of a shame that he values those things because he's probably not going to have the best life possible by valuing them. So instead of getting mad at him, if anything, perhaps I should pity him for the values he has that triggered the insult that he just directed at me. And in a curious way, you transform what could be anger into pity. You know, the Stoics, again, were careful. I don't think you should openly express your pity of the person because that would be itself a form of insult. But it's something in your own mind that you can keep there, and it takes a considerable amount of the sting out of an insult.
And in this context, what do you think Epictetus, the Stoic philosopher, meant when he wrote, "What upsets people is not things themselves, but their judgments about these things"?
Right. Consider this. Here's an example. Suppose you're out for a walk and there's a neighborhood dog that's very territorial, and as soon as you walk by, the dog starts barking at you. I mean, we all agree you'd be foolish if you let that ruin your day. If you said, "Oh, that dog doesn't like me. Oh, dear, what can I do to make that dog like me?" You just ignore it. But now if the neighbor who owns the dog came out and called you a name, you'd probably let that sting you deeply. And it's because your attitude toward the dog is different than your attitude toward the neighbor. You don't care what the dog thinks of you. You do care what the neighbor thinks of you. So what puts the sting in the insult is your own mental attitude. Hey, you have control over your mental attitude. So what makes the insult sting is not the insult itself, but your interpretation of the insult.
We have just a few minutes left with William Irvin, author of A Guide to the Good Life, The Ancient Art of Stoic Joy. Well, we've been talking a lot, Bill, about tranquility and kind of peace of mind, not letting things bother you, keeping desires limited to what you already have. This suggests to some degree that maybe we ought to avoid people, given that they annoy us, they get in our way, even family members can irritate us. Think of, a lot of people talk about the holidays and how difficult those are with family. What did the Stoics believe about the way we ought to relate to and the degree to which we ought to expose ourselves to other people?
Yeah, the Stoics were in a bit of a bind because they realized that other people are the principal source of irritation in our lives. I mean, sometimes things irritate us, our computer loses files or whatever. But usually what irritates us is the behavior of other people. They insult us, they don't respect us enough, they come in and pour out their problems on us. So from one point of view, if you sought tranquility, the sensible thing to do would be to avoid other people. The Stoics also realized that anybody who spends his time avoiding other people is likely to be a miserable human being. They said that the gods created us for each other, that we're gregarious beings, and that if we cut ourselves off from human companionship, we're going to be miserable.
Did they believe we have some kind of duty toward other people?
Yeah, we have a duty toward other people. We have Marcus Aurelius saying, love mankind, which is something a lot of people would agree we ought to do. And his view was that the gods created us to help each other. So the Stoics, particularly Marcus Aurelius, is very big on what I call being socially useful. One of your goals in life, if you're a functioning Stoic, is to try to make yourself useful to your fellow human beings. And the curious thing is, now again, they were interested in living a good life, but I think that that's one component to living a good life, is that you're not just looking out for your own interests, but you're also trying to look out for interests of those around you.
And Bill, finally, you have adopted a Stoic way of life. You're not just describing these techniques in this book, A Guide to the Good Life, but you have practiced them. You have taken it upon yourself to see how they would work in your own life. What has happened to your desire and your sense of well-being since practicing these techniques?
Two notable things. First is, it's ruined me as a consumer. I go to the mall now. I go to the mall and I don't want the stuff. I look around and I just think, look at all the stuff I don't want. And I watch other people. For me, malls are now about people watching, and you can watch them walk through, and they're hoping that desire will be awakened within them. So that's one interesting thing. I don't regret that either. It's not like I'm consciously trying to stop myself from buying stuff. It's just that stuff that at one time seemed so important to me to possess no longer does. The other curious thing is there's an element of joy in my life that previously wasn't there. And it's a curious thing, but these are just little outbursts of joy, just this feeling of well-being of, isn't it wonderful to be alive? to be on this planet. You know, it has a blue sky. The sky didn't have to be blue, but it is. And these people, they're my friends. They didn't have to be my friends, but they are. And a curious thing, when I first experienced that emotion, those little outbursts of joy, there's a real puzzle in my own mind of, well, what should I do with these things? Should I hold them at arm's length? Should I embrace them? And then it dawned on me what foolishness that was. I mean, if you experience joy, embrace it. You're a very lucky person if you can have that emotion.
William Irvin, professor of philosophy at Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio. And we have a link to his book, A Guide to the Good Life, The Ancient Art of Stoic Joy, on our website, againstthegrain.org. We also have a link to his homepage, which displays his other book, On Desire, Why We Want What We Want. Very much appreciate the generosity of your time today, Bill, and thanks so much for writing this book.
Oh, thank you very much for having me on your show.
And this is CS suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we will look for you tomorrow. Against the Grain is produced by C.S. Song with associate producer H.N. Yuen. Noel Hanrahan is at the controls. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you can submit comments and find ways to reach us. You can also call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670.